Hello and welcome to the Hotchkiss & Wiley podcast series. My name is John Hossey, and today I'm joined by David Green, Portfolio Manager on the Hotchkiss & Wiley Value Opportunity Strategy. The revival of value is underway, and we believe we are still in the early innings of this movement. I'll delve into this further with David, but first a few disclosures. This podcast is for general information only and should not be relied on for investment advice or recommendation of any particular security, strategy, or investment product. The portfolio manager's views and opinions expressed in this podcast are as of February 9th, 2021. Such views are subject to change and may differ from others in the firm or the firm as a whole. The portfolio manager's comments include some estimated and/or forecasted views, which are believed to be based on reasonable assumptions within the bounds of current and historical information. However, there is no guarantee that any estimates, forecasts, or views will be realized. In the event of new information or changed circumstances, Hotchkiss & Wiley reserves the right to change its investment perspective and outlook. So, David, thanks for joining me today. Maybe we can start by having you provide our audience with an overview of how the value opportunity strategy is differentiated from other offerings here at Hotchkiss & Wiley.
Sure. So I think the biggest or the most unique attribute of value opportunities is, first of all, we can invest in securities across all market caps. So small caps, mid caps, and large caps, we can invest in all of them. And really what we're looking for in each situation is what is the best risk-adjusted opportunity independent of market capitalization. In addition, this product can also invest across the entire capital structure. So we could buy high yield bonds if we think that they're on a risk-adjusted basis attractive. We can buy preferreds, we can buy converts. It isn't the majority of what we do. The majority of what we do is equities by far, but we have that opportunity when it exists. So if you look at, for example, the top 10 holdings of the product at the end of last year, we had one security, which is a $1.7 trillion market cap in our top 10. And we had another security, which is a $500 million market cap in our top 10. We came upon both of those securities from a bottoms-up analysis, and we bought them because we thought in each case they had excellent risk-adjusted return. Usually you find $500 million securities alongside a lot of other small-cap securities, or you find $1.7 trillion securities alongside other very mega-cap securities. To have both in the top 10, I think, is very unique, and that's one of the unique attributes of this product. But basically, the philosophy behind it is we don't want to be constrained. We don't want to be put into a box of large cap or mid cap or small cap, where we're forced to have to buy certain securities because they fit into a box. We want to buy the best risk-adjusted securities that are available to us. And we have the benefit, quite frankly, of an incredible firm that's been around since 1980, that has 26 investment professionals. And if you think about Hotchkiss & Wiley, I would argue that you should really think about three things when you think about Hotchkiss & Wiley. You should think about research, because we have an unparalleled research platform that really we've invested in, and it's just really quite robust. And it is what allows us to find these securities throughout the market capitalizations. We have a value orientation that is the lifeblood of the firm, and that has been consistent since 1980. And then we have a culture that really looks out long-term to what is the earnings power of companies over long periods of time. So when you take the research and you take the value and you take the culture and you put them together, I think it's a very, very powerful engine that supports this product.
Thanks, David. So you talked about value being the lifeblood of the firm. Toward the end of 2020, the dichotomy between value and growth was near record wide levels. While value has closed the gap a bit recently, there's still a long way to go. Can you talk a little bit about what you were seeing today?
Sure. So the first thing I'd point out, which is hard to believe for many people, is that if you go back for very long periods of time, back to the 1930s, value has consistently outperformed growth. And the reason that may be hard to believe is because recently it has not been the case. In fact, the last 10-year period, the last 10-year and the last 20-year period have been the worst relative performance of value versus growth going back to 1936, which is when we start to have the good data. And before those time periods, value consistently outperformed growth. So what that has left us with today is a situation where value spreads as defined as sort of the excess in multiple that you have to pay to buy a growth stock relative to a value stock. Growth stocks are always going to cost more than than value stocks because they're growing faster. But the question is, how much more are they costing today relative to history? And what we've seen is there have been a few times that they have been more stretched in terms of valuation during the financial crisis, during the Nifty 50, during the period of in March and April of this year. But if you look at where we are today, even though we've had a run, we're still 1.4 standard deviations above where we have been historically. We're in the 90th percentile in terms of value spreads. So yes, we have had a move back in the last quarter, which has been fantastic, and we've enjoyed that. But relative to history, we're still a long ways away from even just the average. And I would point out that if we get back to those historical averages, that still means there's a spread between growth and value. It still means growth stocks are going to be more highly valued than value stocks. It's just that today, that gap is way wider than it has been historically.
So our adherence to the principles of value investing does not mean that we ignore growth prospects or quality or macroeconomic trends. It just means that we compare those qualities to the price the market commands. When that trade-off is in our favor, we invest. When it's not, we pass. Can you give an example of what that entails?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I mean, I always say if you had a crystal ball and you knew exactly what a company was going to earn for, say, the next 100 years, you would just take the dividend stream that company was going to produce. You would discount it at a risk-free rate. You'd take the present value of that dividend stream and you'd compare it to the stock price. And it's entirely possible that a company which is growing quickly can end up being a value stock, meaning that it can have more value than a value company that's low-priced earnings or low-priced book today that is not going to grow or its earnings are going to shrink or its business is under duress. So we actually spend a lot of time thinking about a few different metrics whenever we look at a stock. Business quality is very important to us. We're projecting out earnings 5 years and we're trying to figure out how much a company can earn. And we do indeed factor in what the growth rate of those earnings will in fact be and how good of a business that is and how comfortable and confident we are that those earnings are going to come through. The other things we look at, in addition to business quality, is balance sheet. Does the company have a good balance sheet that can weather a storm? We've just seen one of the biggest storms imaginable in terms of this pandemic and the economy shutting down. So does the company have a balance sheet that it can weather an event like that? The third thing is corporate governance and how the company will use its capital. This is especially important when you're buying small cap stocks because I have seen situations where you have a CEO take a very undervalued company and make an acquisition at a very high price, and all of a sudden overnight you went from having an undervalued security to overvalued. So that's the other thing we look at. And then we look at all of those things in the context of valuation. So once we analyze all three of those factors, we say, okay, how much are we paying for this? And yes, we are going to pay more for a higher quality business that is growing faster because at the end of the day, the present value of that earning stream will be higher when we discount it back than a company that is either not growing or even shrinking. But what we have found, and the reason that we're so consistent to our value disciplines, is we have found that in general, the market gets carried away a lot of times and overpays for a lot of growth that may or may not be there. And so by being disciplined with valuation, we're putting in a margin of safety. But yeah, in fact, we do very much analyze the quality of the business and the underlying growth rates. And for sure, when the business is better and the growth is faster, we are willing to pay more, all else being equal.
Now, you mentioned the wide range of market caps in the top 10, for instance. Today, are you seeing better opportunities down cap as opposed to up cap?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. It's always interesting to me what pops up because, again, we build these portfolios from the bottom up. So we really take our best ideas and they populate the portfolio. Now, I will say, all else being equal, one of the things that we do factor in is liquidity. So a small cap stock, which is going to be by its nature less liquid than a large cap stock, we will require to have more upside to get a bigger position in the portfolio. But having said that, once we factor that in, what ends up populating the portfolio is a function of really the best risk-adjusted returns. Today, I would say if what is probably occurring more than usual is we're finding some interesting stocks in the mid-cap area, kind of the, call it $8 to $15 billion market cap area. We're seeing some interesting ideas, probably more than usual.
Okay, great. You mentioned best ideas. Now, the equity positions make up the bulk of the portfolio right now. You also look for special situations, including what you refer to as opportunistic investments. It looks like special situations are currently near historical lows. So what are you seeing there, or what aren't you seeing there in terms of special situations today?
Yeah, so this portfolio, we define sort of the core of the portfolio as domestic equities. And then anything else we define as a special situation. So it could be an international stock, it could be a high yield bond, it could be a risk arbitrage situation. In that case, it would be an equity, but it would be unique equity. So we would call it a special situation. And there have been various times in the product's history where certain special situations have been more interesting to us than others. For example, during the financial crisis, we had a large percent of the portfolio in risk arbitrage. Risk arbitrage is a situation where a company has a contractual agreement to be bought, the deal has not closed, and the stock is still trading, but there is a pending buyout or merger that is expected to happen according to a contract that has already been signed. What's interesting is risk arbitrage has long been considered relatively safe place to invest because, again, the deal has already been agreed to and the contract has already been signed. During the financial crisis, what we found was spreads, meaning what you could buy the company for in the marketplace versus what the deal price was supposed to close at, was enormous because there were a couple of reasons. Investors were very fearful that the companies wouldn't close the deal, and the natural buyers of those securities most of the time were hedge funds and brokerage firms. In fact, ironically, Bear Stearns was one of the largest, were absent from the marketplace. So the spreads got enormous. So we ended up making that a big piece of the portfolio, and that was very profitable for us coming out of that. Today, risk arbitrage spreads are incredibly low. In fact, some of our recent times that we have had companies be bought out, we've actually sold into the market to the risk arbitrageurs because the spreads, quite frankly, are very low. So special situations are truly a function of what the opportunities are in the marketplace. Today, I would say if I look at where the opportunities are, you know, historically we have had some larger percent of the portfolio, you know, in the 15% kind of on the higher end in fixed income. Today, that number is very low, probably around 2%. We're finding some interesting situations internationally in Europe. We have found some interesting situations, but in general, probably today the best opportunities here are U.S. domestic equities.
Okay. Now, at the end of December, the portfolio had around 50 issuers, with the top five making up approximately 30% of the portfolio, and the top 10 making up close to 50%. Has this been pretty consistent over the history of the strategy?
So I would say today we're slightly more concentrated than we have been historically. If I look historically, the top 10 is typically around 40 to 50%, usually closer to the 40 to 45% area. And today we're at 50%. So we're slightly more concentrated today than we have been historically, but not far away from kind of what I would consider to be normal.
And David, how far will you let your winners run?
Again, all we're trying to do is at every given point in time, which means every day that goes by, trying to figure out from a research perspective what the present value of the earnings stream are of these companies, ultimately the dividend stream. And that will evolve. And, you know, one of the keys, I think, is to always have an open mind and not to put a stake in the ground and say this is what it's going to be, but to allow the events that unfold and as the businesses change and your opinions change to update your models and to make sure that they're reflective of the current reality. So if we have a winner where the business is doing much better than we originally anticipated, what will end up happening is our valuation will go up in terms of what we think it's worth. And then we'll have to make an assessment on whether or not the stock at the new higher price is still attractive, and it may very well be. There have even been situations in the past where we bought stock, the stock's gone up, the business has gotten way better than we thought, and we've actually added to the position at a higher price. So I don't think there's any specific answer. It really is a function of what the underlying business is doing and what the stock price is at that given point in time.
So what sectors are you finding opportunities in today? And are there specific examples that you might be able to provide of the type of companies that you like to see in your portfolio?
Sure. So I would say today, and this is probably typical for a lot of value managers, we're finding that the most interesting opportunities in those sectors in general that are most exposed to the economy. So if you look at the big weights in our portfolio, financials is our biggest weight, tech, which is exposed, although less so, industrials, and then another decent size overweight, although about 10% of the portfolio is energy. And then if you look at where we're really underweight, certainly underweight relative to the Russell 3000 value, we have nothing in utilities, we have very little in consumer staples, and we're underweight healthcare. Those three areas of the market are considered to be the most stable in terms of their earnings, but also because of that, they tend to trade at a very high multiple. So I would say if you look at the sectors that we're exposed to, they're the ones that on average are the more cyclically exposed. One of our biggest holdings in industrials is General Electric. General Electric is a company that has two fantastic businesses and arguably a third that is very underappreciated. The aviation business, where they have about 70% of the jet engine market, is obviously depressed right now because we're in the midst of a pandemic. But the underlying strength of that business is totally intact. And when we could go back to flying, we think the profitability in that business will be quite significant. And if you look at a good sort of comparable, which is Safran, which also competes in that business, trades in Europe, we think the aviation business, if you just looked at what Safran traded at, that business alone is close to the current stock price. You then have the healthcare business, where they own about 50% of the diagnostic imaging. It's an excellent business. Healthcare tends to trade at a high multiple, but because it's inside of GE, it's not being appreciated. If you look at where a good comp would be like a Siemens Healthineers, that business is probably worth about $6 a share. So about half of GE's value is in the healthcare business. And I would note that in the depths of the crisis, GE was trading at around $6 a share. And at the time that the market was valuing healthcare companies, and GE was basically being valued just at the value of its healthcare business, and no valuation was given to its aviation or to power or renewables, which is another couple other businesses they have that we think are also valuable. They have about 50% of the gas turbine market. Those businesses currently are under earning, but we think those are also worth, when you combine the two, between $4 and $5 a share. So you add it all up and you take out the value of the preferreds and the net debt, and GE comes to about around $20 of value in our minds. We may not hold it up until $20. We may, because, you know, we look to buy stocks that have upside, but we think in terms of what it's worth about $20 per share. And we're buying it here today at $11.50. Now, the other thing that I would note about GE is GE has always had these excellent businesses, but quite frankly, it has been undermanaged until Larry Culp came in. And Larry Culp has an excellent reputation. He was the CEO of Danaher. I think he became CEO at age 38. He retired 15 years later at age 53. He was considered an excellent CEO. He created a tremendous amount of value at Danaher. And then he retired and he joined the board of GE thinking that he was going to be retired and just enjoy his retired life. When GE ran into problems, they asked Larry if he would be CEO, and he agreed to, and this was about 2 years ago. And in our minds, you're really taking an unbelievable talent who had demonstrated an ability to execute quite successfully for many, many years, and you were having him lead a company that at the end of the day had fantastic businesses and fantastic products underneath it. We've been in this pandemic, so we haven't been able to see what the true profitability of aviation can be. But when we do get out of this, I think people are going to be very surprised at how profitable that business is. I think they're going to continue to be surprised, as we have been, how well healthcare is doing. And I think they're going to be very surprised that the power business, which not too long ago was considered an albatross, is actually going to end up being a very profitable business for GE. So that's an example of a stock that we think still has a lot of value, has a $100 billion market cap, not too long ago during the dot-com era. I think it was the largest company in the U.S. I think it had a market cap over $500 billion. So we're very far away from where we have been. We're not expecting to get back to where we were, but we think that where we are today is way below where we should be in terms of valuation. Another example I'll give you is Wells Fargo. This product has owned a lot of different banks over its history, but one bank which we very seldomly owned has been Wells Fargo until the last few years. And the reason we had seldomly owned it was because Wells Fargo was always trading at a very high multiple. It's an excellent franchise. It's got $1.25 trillion of deposits. You could not create Wells Fargo today from scratch if you tried. It's really just a fantastic business. And it's the second largest depository institution in the U.S. It's the third largest retail brokerage in the U.S. It's currently under a cloud, and we tend to buy businesses that are under a cloud if we think that the cloud is temporary, and we think the business fundamentals and the business fundamentally is a good business, which in the case of Wells Fargo, we certainly do. We think that Wells Fargo, when it comes out of the situation it's in, where it's operating under an asset cap for the scandal that it got involved in opening up fake accounts, we think when it comes out of that, the company can earn in excess of $6 a share. Our normal earnings is actually $6.50 a share. Now, some of that is a reversion of rates back to a more normal level. But even if rates do not revert back up, we still think this company at current rates can earn between $4.75 and $5 a share. The stock currently is trading at around $33. So you can see that this is a very, very low multiple for an excellent franchise, and a franchise that, quite frankly, historically has always been valued at a high multiple. But because of the current situation today, we're able to buy it at what we believe is a very attractive valuation.
Thanks, David. So Hotchkiss & Wiley historically is not immune to holding names with some controversy. Can you talk a little bit about how you manage risk in the portfolio?
Yeah, so I think that the most important way, you know, when you think about risk, and I think it's a great question, because I think if you really want to understand an investor's philosophy, you have to understand how they think about risk. And I think that the way we think about risk is by looking at the attributes that we're buying in each company. So the first attribute, the most important way to manage risk is valuation. Are we buying the security at a good valuation? Because if we are, then things can happen along the way. I always say, no matter what you buy, if you buy a car, if you buy a house, if you buy a suit, if you buy it at a good price and things don't always work out as you expected, you have a margin of safety. So that's the first way we manage risk is valuation. The second, as I mentioned before, is balance sheet. So we're looking for companies that can weather a storm with their balance sheet. We have an underlying business. We think it has a certain earnings power. There could be a situation where temporarily things aren't going the way we think they should. But as long as they have a balance sheet that they can get through that temporary situation, that's a huge risk mitigant. The third is the business a fundamentally good business? If we turned off our computers, our Bloombergs, and we came back in 10 years, would we have a good idea of where this company would be positioned? Is it competitively well positioned in the marketplace? And then corporate governance. Does the company do the right thing with their capital? Are they buying back stock? Are they paying dividends? Are they investing wisely? If we have all of those attributes, we have a lot of our risks mitigated, assuming we do. Now, I will tell you, quite frankly, it's very hard to find all of those attributes to the extent we want. Usually, it's rare to get great valuation, a great balance sheet, unbelievable business quality, and tremendous corporate governance. You oftentimes have to give up a little bit somewhere, because the best business qualities usually have higher valuations. But sometimes we find situations where there's a cloud that's currently over a stock that we think is temporary, and we're actually able to get a lot of these attributes. And so when we have that, those tend to be bigger positions in the portfolio. There are times when we might not have as high a business quality, but we have unbelievable valuation. If I told you that you could buy a piece of land that was worth $1 million and you could buy it for $500,000, that would be a good deal. Now, that wouldn't mean it's a good business. It's mean it's a good opportunity. And so those opportunities will present themselves, but we just have to be very careful that we understand exactly what we're doing. And we realize that if we're buying something that isn't as good of a business, that we know that once the valuation reaches close to our target, we sell that. So that's really the way we mitigate risk in the portfolio, is looking at those areas, the valuation, the balance sheet, the business quality, and the corporate governance.
Got it. And one last question. I think I know the answer, but I have to ask, as it's the topic du jour. Would you ever consider Bitcoin as part of your special situations basket?
No. The whole theory on making money on Bitcoin is predicated on your ability to sell it to somebody else who will pay a higher price. There's no intrinsic value in Bitcoin. I mean, there are intrinsic values in the securities we buy. They're going to pay us dividends. They're going to be buying back their own stock if it gets too cheap. But there's no intrinsic value in Bitcoin. Your only hope of making money on Bitcoin is that somebody will pay you more money for it. So we would never invest in Bitcoin, and I wouldn't be surprised if Bitcoin doesn't end well.
All right, David. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And with that, we thank you, our audience, for your interest in the Hotchkiss & Wiley Value Opportunity Strategy. For further information, please visit www.hwcm.com or call us at 888-596-4926. Thank you.